Hi, everybody, and welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Holger Dressler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Joanna Poblete, an associate professor of history at Claremont Graduate University in California, about a new book, Balancing the Tides, Marine Practices in American Samoa, published by University of Hawaii Press earlier this year. Joanna Poblete, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joanna, I wonder if you could begin by telling our listeners a bit about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. So I was born in San Francisco, California, and my background is Chinese, Filipino, Portuguese, American. And I really was exposed to a lot of different kinds of cultures and backgrounds as I was growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I did my undergraduate work at UC Davis, where I had a BA in history and a minor in Asian American studies. And then I went on to get my master's and PhD at UCLA. So all of these parts of my journey have really encouraged me and inspired me to become a historian of unincorporated territories.
Great. Thanks. So growing up in California with an eye towards the Pacific, how did you come to write this book about marine practices in American Samoa?
Yeah, it's actually been a bit of a trajectory. So when I was an undergrad at UC Davis, I wrote an honors thesis that focused on the 1935 Repatriation Act of Filipinos, where the U.S. federal government paid for the free transport of any Filipino to return to Manila if they promised to never come back to the United States again. So this study of really the culmination of anti-Filipino sentiment on the West Coast during the Great Depression, as well as the fact that Filipinos are, at the time, were wards of the United States, U.S. nationals. This really generated my interest in unincorporated territories and Filipino legal history in particular. So when I went to UCLA for my graduate education, I quickly enrolled in a law school class on Asian American jurisprudence. And in that course, I realized that the studies in this course that we were examining focused mostly on citizens of foreign nations, so Chinese, Japanese, Korean cases, and the impact that law has on mostly East Asians and their impact on the law as well. And this did not really coincide with much of what I understood the Filipino legal experience to be. And so this really led me to start looking into the War of 1898 and the subsequent Treaty of Paris, and then the Insular Cases ruling, which really categorized Filipinos along with Puerto Ricans and Chamorros in Guam and Guahan as belonging to, but not part of, the United States. And so that became my real aha moment in grad school, where I feel like I ran to my advisor's office and I said, I want to study all liminal groups who have come under direct U.S. colonial authority in different places and in different time periods so that we can think in a much more expansive way about the longer patterns of U.S. expansionism and colonialism. And my advisor at the time, Henry Yu, who's at UBC now, he said, you know, I'm so glad that you have found what you're passionate about and really a great focus. But this overall idea is actually a long-term career goal, and it's not necessarily a manageable dissertation project. So he actually recommended that I take two of these groups that I was interested in and think about where they come together in a particular place or experience and use that as my initial case study. And then my next book could be about a different area. And that really, that kind of guidance has guided my actual career trajectory. So I when I wrote my dissertation, and which became my first book on Filipino and Puerto Rican sugar plantation workers who moved to work on the plantations of the second colonized space of the U.S. territory of Hawaii, I always knew in the back of my mind that the next place that I really wanted to study was American Samoa, because there has just been not enough attention to this particular region, especially within the larger narrative of U.S. history, and in particular from the perspective of historians. And my focus on the post-World War II period are all things that we haven't seen a lot of work on. And I feel that, as we will talk about in terms of the chapters, there are some major ways in which what happens in American Samoa, what happens to the indigenous people of American Samoa, has direct impact on much larger American, federal, and even global issues. So once I was finished with my dissertation, I was actually on a postdoc at UNC Chapel Hill in history there. And at the end of that postdoc, I was able to start my research on American Samoa. And I actually was very fortunate that one of my best friends from high school, her father actually worked with someone who worked very closely with the congressional delegate to American Samoa in Washington, D.C. And so when I went on my initial research trip in 2008, she really took me under her wing. She is my American Samoan mother, and her family is my family there. And she wouldn't even let me stay in a hotel after meeting me for the first 30 minutes. So she actually was able to help introduce me to many of the people that I talked to on my initial research trip. And my goal on that research trip was really to not be an outsider who's coming in and trying to tell the indigenous people like what is important in their history, that I actually wanted to talk to people and say, what do you think about the impact that being an unincorporated territory of the United States has on your life, has had on the history of this place and space, and what has changed. And so after sitting down with various community leaders in lots of different areas and kind of departments of the government as well, I really decided that a focus on marine practices and ocean use was a central theme that was coming out of a lot of the discussions that I was having. And because American Samoa is surrounded by the ocean, and the ocean is such a key part of the traditional culture, that it's important to really think through how these marine practices and ocean uses have shifted over time, particularly under the colonial relationship with the United States.
Great. Thanks for this trajectory that led you to this book. I noticed reading the book, there are several central themes in it. It's obviously a book about the U.S. empire, as you mentioned, about a place within the U.S. empire that we don't always think about as much. It's even more specifically about policymaking in this unincorporated territory, which I think is quite interesting also for non-historians, for political scientists, and actual policymakers to be thinking about the different levels of policymaking there. And it's also an environmental history and a labor history. So let's delve a little bit deeper into the specific arguments of your book. In your first chapter, you write about commercial fishing in American Samoa. Can you set the scene for us? Maybe tell us a little bit about American Samoa, where it is, a little bit of its history, why it became a U.S. unincorporated territory, and then how commercial fishing developed on the island.
Sure. So American Samoa is officially consists of five islands and two atolls in the South Pacific. It's the southernmost territory of the United States, and it is situated in the last time zone of the globe. It's about 2,600 miles southwest of Hawaii, and a little more than 4,700 miles southwest of the continental U.S. West Coast. Now, the total landmass of these five islands and two atolls is about 77 square miles. And based on the 2010 census, the population was recorded at 55,519 people. Now, American Samoa becomes quote-unquote American officially in 1900 when the U.S. Navy negotiates a deed of cession with the local chiefs on the main island of Tituila. And there's a second set of negotiations in 1904, which actually happened today. Today is Manua Day in 1904. And as part of these treaties, there is an agreement between the two parties that local governance would be given to the indigenous population, and that the U.S. federal government was more of a supervisory and authoritative entity that oversaw trade and military issues and economic issues. So we have American Samoa being important in different moments of U.S. history, and again, both in kind of visible and invisible ways. One as a Navy port, especially important during World War II, a major site for tuna canning, which we'll talk about when we discuss Chapter 2 of this book, and also the location of the largest national marine sanctuary in U.S. jurisdiction, which again, I think not many people know about. So in terms of the first chapter and looking at commercial fishing, basically this chapter, like the other chapters in the book, are trying to highlight a couple of things. One thing is the impact that Western influence or U.S. colonialism has had on the indigenous of American Samoa, and particularly on their daily lives. And so what you have happening, particularly during World War II and after, is a shift from a more subsistence-based lifestyle, living off the land and the ocean, to a cash-based economy where local fishers are now being encouraged to fish for commercial purposes, and particularly for the tuna canneries that are established in the 1960s, that the kind of fishing that starts to be encouraged by the U.S. federal government through actual government subsidies and funding programs are Western styles of fishing, Western kinds of equipment, motorized boats, metal hooks, monofilament lines, as well as a Western approach to thinking about the ocean in general and the kind of uses and rationality, and also thinking about the profitability of the ocean, which are very different from the ways in which ocean use for traditional Samoan culture is much more about a reciprocity as well as a use for both social and cultural ceremonies, but not necessarily for exploitation for corporate profit. So in chapter one, I talk about how the U.S. Department of Commerce, through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA, and specifically their arm of the National Marine Fisheries Service, basically is in control of the water around American Samoa from 3 miles out to 200 miles. After 200 miles, that's considered international waters, and under 3 miles to shore are considered territorial waters. And so this is a kind of very clear moment of loss of indigenous control over their ancestral waters that has been in effect since 1976, when the exclusive economic zones were starting to be created by different nations across the globe, and including the United States. And what we find, and again, this is a theme in all of the chapters, is that the priority that gets created by these Western approaches, and particularly U.S. federal programming, is to protect ocean resources for human consumption and long-term preservation for this consumption as well, both for the U.S. overall as well as global markets. So we have the Western Pacific Fisheries Council, also known as WESPAC, which is the local arm of the National Marine Fisheries, who, contrary to other fishery councils in the United States, were working to protect the interests of indigenous fishers since 2002, that basically, because of the deeds of cession from the turn of the 20th century, there's always this underlying mandate that the U.S. federal government has to be cognizant and sensitive to indigenous rights and access to things like their land and the ocean. So, so in this chapter, I look at a couple of the pieces of legislation that WESPAC supports to limit who can actually fish in the waters around American Samoa. In 2002, there's a large vessel prohibited area that protects up to 50 miles from shore for only small-scale American Samoan fisher people. But you have the decline of these commercial fishers starting in 2005. And by the time we get to 2014, there's really only, according to NOAA, one active commercial fisher at the small scale level, which are known as ALEAs. And so you have this federal entity that has created a pattern of really trying to uplift the needs of indigenous fishers, and now coming into conflict with one subset of these American Samoan fisher people. Because in addition to small-scale fishers, you also have medium-sized longliner vessels, which are also owned by some American Samoans. And these two groups are actually have been vying for access to these protected waters. And so one of the themes that comes out of this chapter as well is the way in which we shouldn't be homogenizing indigenous peoples, right? That yes, they're all commercial fisher people, but ultimately the kind of motivations and the desires and the needs of the small scale versus medium scale fishers don't always coincide and actually conflict, to the point where you have in 2015 the reduction of the large vessel prohibited area from 50 miles to 12 miles so that these medium scale boats can now fish closer to home. And this causes a lot of tension in the community. You have the territorial governor actually filing a lawsuit against NOAA to stop this reduction of this protected area. And in 2017, you actually have a U.S. district court in Honolulu ruling in favor of the territorial government to say that the protection of indigenous waters takes precedent over federal authority and the economic exclusive zone, that basically the deeds of cession are the kind of the fundamental basis of the relationship of the United States with American Samoa. So this is actually huge. This is something that I am really looking forward to seeing how this now new ruling will have an impact long-term for U.S. relations in American Samoa, but also for other unincorporated territories, both in the Pacific and in the Caribbean, who could use this court case for their own interests. So chapter one overall is highlighting how the federal fishing regulations that all fishers work within, negotiate around, all over U.S. fishing waters are actually really grounded in the kind of the politics and the tensions that are occurring amongst different kinds of indigenous fishers in American Samoa, but that it's an invisible story that we don't hear about much, and that in fact, if we take a closer look at the history of indigenous marine management, that we could actually find some alternatives to the kinds of practices that have been supported in terms of how do we combat overfishing of tuna in particular in this region and in the Pacific overall.
Speaking of tuna, much of the fish that's being caught by these commercial fishers, small and large, is tuna that ends up in canneries in Tutuila, two canneries that are built in the 1950s and 60s. One of them, actually the Starkist, you write, cannery is one of the largest cannery in the world until maybe 10 years ago or so, which is an amazing, I think, story in and of itself that we don't really think about, right? We might buy some tuna in the supermarket, but we don't always check where the tuna actually comes from. And American Samoa, because of its unincorporated status, has these economic advantages for tuna production and for other elements as well. So let's delve a little bit deeper into the tuna canning industry, which I really found it fascinating, this chapter. It looks at labor, it looks at struggles over the minimum wage, and the legal and economic status of American Samoa as an unincorporated territory. So can you tell us a little bit more about what these tuna canneries are all about and how that played out in the last half century or so?
Sure, absolutely. So the story I always tell people when they say, oh, you're studying American Samoa, that sounds interesting, but very specific and narrow. And the story I always tell them is that until 2009, the majority of the tuna, canned tuna, that you would buy in the United States, whether it's from Whole Foods or Walmart or Trader Joe's or, you know, whatever local store you have, is coming from two canneries on American Samoa. These cans of tuna get the labels change depending on what palette they are putting together and who it's getting shipped to, but it's the same labor of folks in American Samoa who are not being paid the same minimum wage or having the same regulations in terms of maximum work hours because of their unincorporated territorial status. Now, what I really focus on in this chapter that I think is important to highlight is that when the U.S. federal government started providing tax and tariff breaks, as well as the territorial government, to Starkist and eventually Chicken of the Sea, that the priority in terms of establishing this monocrop export-based industry was for the financial benefit of these tuna corporations, that it wasn't necessarily focused on the interests of how can we as the federal government help to support and foster a diverse type of economic structure to really help support and help American Samoa thrive. But in fact, time after time, as we go through the history of the tuna canneries in American Samoa, that every time there's a decision point, it's always it's always in favor of these big tuna corporations. And the case that I talk about in terms of the increasing of the minimum wage in American Samoa to try to get it to be even with that of the continental United States, which starts in 2007, that even this effort, which on the surface sounds reasonable, right? That from a Western perspective, from the United States, a living wage is something we have heard about. But really, the debate and the push for it in the U.S. Congress was really based on partisan party politics in the U.S. Congress, not necessarily concern for the needs and desires of the indigenous population in American Samoa. So what you have is a system that gets created initially with differential labor standards to attract these tuna corporations, right, to establish their businesses in American Samoa, that this made in the USA label that they get to use because this is an unincorporated territory becomes even more profitable when you have military contracts that require goods to be made in the USA, right? But that there is a necessity to parse out what that really means when we acknowledge the central and crucial role that unincorporated territories play in these major tuna canning and export industries. So just like in my first book, when I looked at the sugar plantations, right, the cultivation of sugar for the continental United States was really the priority in terms of labor recruitment and the actual kinds of legislation that applied or did not apply in Hawaii. In my next book that looks at the U.S. Virgin Islands, the oil refinery on St. Croix, again, gets these tax and tariff breaks for the benefit of stateside oil companies and has a pretty negative impact on the health and the environment of people in these islands that are not very big. So this chapter looks at how there's this assumption that from, again, a kind of Western and American perspective, that, oh, if we just paid everyone a living wage, then everyone would be okay. But what has happened with this increase that starts in 2007, and so the legislation that was passed required a 50-cent increase every year until the minimum wage in American Samoa met that of the continental U.S. In 2007, the minimum wage in American Samoa was $3.26 versus $5.85 in the continental U.S. But after 2 years of these increases, one of the two major canneries closed in 2009, citing the extra costs that they have had to incur for paying these higher wages. And so you see the situation where workers who we would assume would want to have a higher wage are actually shying away from the push for more wage increases because, when they would rather have a job than not have a job. Many of the manual labor positions are being filled by Samoans from independent Samoa, and they are earning U.S. dollars at a much higher rate than they would back in independent Samoa or other folks who live in different Pacific islands in the region. And so there's this really interesting support among some people in American Samoa to keep the tuna canning industry in American Samoa at any cost, right? Because since the 1960s, this tuna canning industry has been the major source of private revenue for American Samoa. The other major source of GNP are federal grants from the US government. And so there is this sense that even though a subsistence lifestyle and independence, basic independence on a daily basis from the United States was happening up until World War II, there is this fear, almost like a colonial mentality, where some folks feel that they need to protect this industry in order to avoid a total collapse of the economy. You even have the congressional delegate at the time talking about how American Samoa is not a state of the union, right? And so why are we treating them like a state of the union? The population is lower, the resources are lower, the infrastructure is not the same. And so the kinds of expectations that are being placed in a blanket way on unincorporated territories are actually not taking into consideration the types of economic structures that were initially created by the US federal government that has now created this massive sense of dependence on this industry. So so you have the wage increases being reduced from 50 cents to 40 cents, and instead of every year, it goes down to every 3 years because of the complaints that are coming from American Samoa, from politicians and leaders who are saying these congresspeople in the US don't understand who we are, what our history has been, and what we need to survive. And that difference between continental concerns and Western perspectives of protecting ideas of a living wage or even just the tuna corporations comes into conflict with the needs of American Samoans who really value this idea of va, which is a kind of social space relations where you, in any relationship you have, whether it's with another human being or with the land or with sea life, that there should be this reciprocity and mutual respect. And so you also have this really interesting situation where a lot of the workers in the canneries are very grateful for the industrial social welfare programs that are coming out of the canneries. The canneries acknowledge that that in traditional Samoan culture, there is an expectation to provide gifts for funerals or for weddings, and as well to take time out of your regular daily schedule to attend these ceremonies. And you have Starkus actually providing specific funeral benefits for workers in American Samoa to accommodate these cultural practices. And that kind of respect and acknowledgement and integration of traditional Samoan culture has actually helped the workers actually feel like these corporations are looking out for their needs and their interests enough to shy away from organizing in unions or for pushing for higher wages. But what you see in this case is the prioritization of global market consumption for canned tuna over the needs of American Samoans in their homeland.
That's a fascinating story. And I think it helps us to reframe debates about labor history, about the history of capitalism, and the history of the present of the U.S. empire through the lens of American Samoa. As you mentioned, if you think about minimum wage debates in the fully incorporated United States, It looks quite different if you actually see those debates and their effects from Tutuila and from the canneries there. I was really struck that when you wrote about sort of the partisan background of these minimum wage debates, Nancy Pelosi's district in the Bay Area, where you're from, and then there's representatives from Georgia, where there's the Chicken of the Sea plant moves to. So I think that chapter really reminds us to have a broader view of the U.S. empire that takes into account unincorporated territories beyond the continental United States. Shifting gears to the two other chapters in your book, the third chapter is about the National Marine Sanctuary of American Samoa. So much of an environmental history, policy-oriented questions about conservation and science. Can you tell us a little bit more about this biggest National Marine Sanctuary within the United States, as you mentioned earlier, that I think we know too little about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so again, this is another invisible aspect of the importance that American Samoa plays in within U.S. jurisdiction. And what is so interesting about this case study is that at the beginning, the establishment of this marine sanctuary was actually initiated by the American Samoan territorial governor, Peter T. Coleman, in 1982, that he recognized that one of the advantages of being an unincorporated territory is that you could leverage these environmental protections to protect one's own ancestral waters. And so he is the one who develops a proposal and proposes to NOAA that a 0.25 square mile bay, Whangatele Bay, becomes part of the National Marine Sanctuary system of the United States, because this bay had been identified as extremely diverse, but also a victim of the crown of thorns invasive starfish. So basically the coral reefs in the 1980s of this particular bay were pretty devastated. And he had been talking to scientists and folks in NOAA, and they decided they felt that this bay could be a great in situ lab for how do coral reefs recover from both natural and man-made devastation, because you also have effluent going into the ocean at this time because there are massive infrastructure projects to pave roads, the major ring road around American Samoa at the time. So this establishment of the marine sanctuary was something that when I interviewed folks on island, in the islands, that they had positive things to say about the creation, right? That there was this belief that the process that was engaged was cooperative, that it was collaborative, and you have this moment of the interests of the indigenous population and the U.S. federal government and environmental and science folks coming together and saying, yes, this is an opportunity that all of the parties involved can see the benefit from. Of course, if you look closely at the comment period, the reaction of the community, not there are people who are wondering what the National Marine Sanctuary means for indigenous control over their ancestral waters, which ultimately is lost. It's ultimately a story of dispossession, because once an area becomes part of the National Marine Sanctuary, that becomes federally controlled water in perpetuity. That is the assumption that gets made and created when an area is designated. And so when we come into the 2010s, you actually have a top-down desire from NOAA, both in Washington, D.C., as well as the NOAA officials of the Office of Marine Sanctuaries in American Samoa, who are really interested in expanding the sanctuary, and they start to hold community meetings. But from the testimony that many community members provided on the U.S. Federal Register, they thought that this idea of expanding the sanctuary was just an idea. They didn't realize that there was actually a strong set of supporters in the federal government and in this federal agency to push to expand this sanctuary from 0.25 square miles to eventually 13,581 square miles, and to include five more sites across American Samoa. Now, this violation of VA, right, that a lot of the community members express in their Federal Register comments, are really angry and really pointed, that they really feel that the federal process of hearings and environmental assessments does not coincide with the traditional Samoan decision-making process, which I talk about briefly in this chapter, but I also talk more about in chapter four, where basically if you want a decision to be made in a community, what you do is you approach the village Matai, the village chiefs, and you present them with your proposal, and then you also meet with the women's group as well as the untitled men, and then folks in the community come together and they talk about the proposal. They debate and they think through all the pros and cons, and then eventually the village Matai make a decision on behalf of the entire village, and whatever that decision is, everyone in the community abides by. And this process could take up to 2 years. It's slow and it's deliberate, but it is the main way that decision making occurs in American Samoa, which is again guaranteed by the deeds of cession from the turn of the century. So even though the U.S. federal government feels like their 6-month comment period, which they actually increased to 8 months because of the uproar from the community, that this process still was in so much tension with the expectations that, one, had been set by the deed of cession, but also, two, set by the initial creation of this marine sanctuary in 1986 is when it officially becomes Whangateli Bay National Marine Sanctuary, that this is a huge disappointment to the community, and every initiative, environmental initiative that is external that comes into American Samoa after the sanctuary expansion is plagued with this skepticism and this lack of interest by members of the community, because they just felt they were burned so badly by the process that even though NOAA did try to address all of the concerns that were brought up during the 8-month comment period about the expansion, there was still this bad taste in the mouth of folks in the community that they just were not listened to, that this decision had already been made to expand the sanctuary, and that they had the meetings because U.S. federal mandate requires that they had a comment period, but that fundamentally, again, you have the prioritization of Western scientific research and the Western ideas of protecting the ocean for future use, but that comes in direct conflict with the indigenous right to access ancestral waters.
This tension between Samoan ways of life and Euro-American ways of conservation and thinking about the environment that you trace in chapter three is also the topic then of your last chapter in the book. It's really a thread running through the entire book, this conflict, where you talk about the U.S., what you call the U.S. imperial grants system. I think that's quite of a new term, at least to me. So the money that comes from the federal government to local programs, in this case, environmental programs, as well as data collection on phishing, which you say is necessary, but quite difficult, as most data collection is. So can you talk us through this last chapter and how marine practices figure in American Samoa connected to the funding that comes from DC and also the data collection connected to these programs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so chapter four really looks at local indigenous programming for ocean use and marine practices. And I look at two examples, one of community-based fisheries management programs where the local Department of Marine and Wildlife Resources goes out and it actually engages in that village communication decision-making process that I just described to you that is also related to chapter three. And there is so they go and they meet with the chiefs and the entitled men and the women. They let the community decide what kind of restrictions they want to place on their marine protected area, so the shores of their particular village. And any decision that gets made is not permanent. So basically, if a village says, okay, we have seen the destruction of coral, and so we want to restrict these kinds of fishing for now, if they decide in 3 years, which has happened in this program, where villages see fish that haven't been in their waters for years actually come back after instituting a village-based marine protected area, that they decide, okay, these rules and regulations have done their job, and so now let's lift it, right? Because that's really at the core of American Samoan marine management, is that when there is an issue, when there's a need, you act, and you act quickly, but that any action is not necessarily a long-term solution, that there should be a constant evaluation of the health of the water, of the needs of the community, and also the ways in which there are also, again, social and cultural bases for fishing for certain kinds of sea life or materials. So this program, in one sense, is an example of a successful program that is very conscientious of VA, Samoan VA. But at the same time, they are funded by the U.S. federal government. And so they are beholden to the bureaucratic requirements of federal grant making and applications and follow-up. If they don't fill the paperwork out just right, that could mean they lose funding for an entire year, right? The funding that they get from the federal government for these programs are allotted on a yearly basis, and they're never guaranteed. And so this creates a lot of stress amongst the employees who work in these programs, both for the marine protected areas as well as data collection, because they're trying to balance both the needs of their community, what is appropriate, proper VA, but also making sure that they are abiding by the terms and the requirements and the expectations of the U.S. federal grant system so that they can get that money. And when we look at the data collection program, which is the other entity that I examine in chapter four, we see that data is central to any federal grants, that if you can't prove your need or the ways in which you're being successful in your program, that lack of information can result in loss of funding or no funding at all. So you have folks like Ray Tulafono, who was the first director of the Department of Marine and Wildlife Resources, saying we have to get data, because he understood that from a U.S. federal government perspective, that's the key into this funding, and that's the way you maintain support, and that's the way that we can then support fishers in the community. But the reality is that they're still very underfunded. That if some, you know, there's only a few people who go out on a regular basis, about two or three people, to collect data from both fishers onshore as well as coming in on boats, in and out on boats. Vehicles, you need vehicles to get around quickly. There's no way going around quickly on Tituila, right? There's one ring road with one lane each way, and the maximum speed is 20 miles an hour. But you know, vehicles break down, and then you have to wait for a part to come from either Hawaii or the continental U.S. And again, you're collecting data either really early in the morning or really late at night, because that's when fishers are coming in from their trips. And sometimes the fishers don't want to talk to you because they know maybe they caught something that, according to Western standards, isn't good for the ecology, but is something maybe they have been catching for years. That's part of their family tradition to serve at a wedding or a funeral. So in both these cases, there's strong indigenous leadership involved, and there is a high regard to traditional Samoan customs, but the fact that these programs are funded by the U.S. federal government, that kind of undercuts the kinds of programming and advancement that can be made by these programs.
Thanks for the overview of the book. I wanted to ask you towards the end of our interview about what you learned about the book since it came out. It just came out a few months ago. I was curious, since we live in a quite turbulent world, what kind of responses have you gotten from people in American Samoa, from other folks who read the book, and what, if anything, has changed in your analysis and in your approach since the book came out?
Right. So I was very fortunate to be part of the Sustainable History Monograph Project funded by the Mellon Foundation, where they are taking, I think now it's about 80 books on environmental history and turning them into open access, free PDFs in perpetuity, in conjunction with academic presses. So University of Hawaii approached me when I finished the manuscript and all the revisions to ask if I'd be willing to be one of the first participants in this program. And I, you know, after making sure that my institution would not feel that would be problematic for tenure and promotion, things like that, I was really on board, because I think this is really the future of academic publishing, and it's particularly in a pandemic moment when students and scholars are struggling to get access to materials, that being able to share our academic research with anyone who is interested, right? Whether they want to just look up and see where their name is, right? Because I one of the things that's always been hard for me is when I go into a community and I work so closely with them, you know, I interviewed over 100 people for this book, and I would love to give everyone, every single person, a copy, a physical copy of the book, but that, just as we know, on academic salaries is not possible. But now I can send them a link and they can download it, they can share it with their friends. And so for me, part of the reception for this book has been the ability of not only the people who are featured in the book, who I talked to come to the conclusions that I had in the book, but also people who I'm working with for my next project in the U.S. Virgin Islands. They're reading this book and saying, wow, is this something that you're hoping to do in a similar way for the Virgin Islands? And seeing the kinds of connections that are common across unincorporated territories, that has been really amazing. And then you also have the fact that once I sent out the link to anyone who I thought would be interested in it, I had two colleagues immediately assign the book for their classes in the next month, that started the next month, because it was so easily accessible. And I think in terms of the, you know, what's happening with COVID, as well as with the social unrest and the global unrest in terms of systems of oppression, I think that the current moment is really highlighting how we need to be conscientious of Indigenous struggles, right? The struggles of people of color, of Black people in the U.S., but also those who are oppressed across the globe, right? And that governments of nations that are either currently colonizers or even have legacies of colonialism and imperialism in other places around the world need to think very carefully about how they want to move forward, because we are moving into a new kind of society where the mistreatment of peoples based on racial hierarchies and whatnot are no longer acceptable. And then on a final note, in terms of COVID, you know, studies have been coming out about how Pacific Islanders are also disproportionately affected by the pandemic. And again, this is another way in which Pacific Islanders have been made invisible by health systems and health statistics and the U.S. federal government, and that, again, we need to start thinking more carefully and working towards building more equitable and inclusive programming, whether it's in health or in environmental justice or society in general.
I couldn't agree more. Coming back to your open access publication system, I think that's really great because your book is engaged in thinking about knowledge production in so many ways. So I think it's quite fitting that you were able to publish this book as open access, which makes it so easily accessible for everybody. You did mention your next book, so I just wanted to end by asking you to elaborate a little bit more. It sounds like you're moving to the Caribbean, to the U.S. Virgin Islands, and it sounds like your fourth book could be a synthesis of unincorporated territory, if I'm not jumping ahead too far in your career plans. But tell us a little bit more about the U.S. Virgin Islands project, how far along you are and what you're working on there, and anything that you wanted to share about this project?
Sure. Yeah, it's actually a little bit of a return to the Caribbean, since my first book was also about Puerto Ricans. But yeah, I am, again, just like I felt that it was so important to do a very in-depth historical study of American Samoa for all the reasons we've already discussed, I also think that the U.S. Virgin Islands is another place that has been really ignored by the U.S. Historical narrative, let alone the U.S. public and the U.S. federal government. And so I started my research for this project about 3 years ago, and I did the same thing that I did with my research in American Samoa. I went for an initial research trip, and I just tried to talk to as many people as possible, because, again, as academics, we market in these terms of colonialism and post-colonialism and indigenous futurity, things like that. But when we're talking about people who are on the ground and living downwind from the heavy industry complex on St. Croix, they're not using those terms, right? Like the term that I use to think in a synthetic way about unincorporated territories is this idea of U.S. colonials, or people who have come under the direct authority of the United States, which is different, which can be a temporary situation, a liminal space. But I wanted to go and talk to as many people as possible and just find out, okay, everyone there knows they're an unincorporated territory, right? They know that they are sub to the continental United States. And what do people, whether they, again, are just a community member or a leader in the government, what do they think has been the largest impact that being part of the United States has had on them, on their family, and on the history of the space and place they are from? And it boggled my mind that from 1965 to 2013, one of the largest oil refineries in the world that was providing gas and diesel for the southern and eastern coasts of the United States was on St. Croix of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Again, a small island. And so I started to delve deeper in during my second research trip on this oil refinery, especially because I had done so much work on environmental issues in the second book. I thought, okay, this would be a good dovetail. But then I realized that the story I really want to tell is about the invisible role that women have played in the establishment, the maintenance, as well as work against this oil refinery. You have the landowner who gives the initial land grant for the refinery being a Crujian woman, a woman from St. Croix, Afro-Caribbean, who negotiates very harshly with Leon Hess, the head of Hess Oil, and has him sitting on her doorstep outside with his head in his hands, because she is more interested in making sure she's cooking dinner for her community than negotiating with this stateside businessman. You have administrative assistants and custodial services who are women working actually in the refinery, right? Women may not be the actual oil refiners, but they are there and they are crucial to the continual and smooth functioning of the actual refinery. And then you have environmental scientists, you have lawyers, you have doctors and nurses, as well as educators and community activists who are really trying to question what the true benefits are of this industry for their community. So this book is going to be looking at health as well as environmental justice issues, but from the lens of a Crujian women's history and Afro-Caribbean women's history, and to really move away from the male patriarchal masculine stories that are out there about the oil industry and even about ecology, about the business world and environmental studies, so that we can have an even more full picture of what's happening in the USVI. And you're right, I would love for the fourth book to be kind of a synthesis work now that I've done this really close study of several unincorporated territories. So that's down the road.
Sounds like two great projects coming up. I want to thank you for being on the show today, Joanna. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you.